No.
Let me ask it. Okay, shall I ask the question again?
Yeah, ask the question again. That'd be great.
Yeah. Okay, so Patrick asked last week, how do astronomers measure the distance to distant stars and galaxies? And is a follow-up question is, how do we know that the creation event happened 13 plus billion years ago?
Okay, those are two distinct questions, but they are related. In terms of being able to measure distances, the distances astronomers measure are all based on an assumption-free method. That assumption-free method is basically using the same technique that surveyors use to measure distances here on Earth, where they set up these little telescopes at different positions. And they basically take advantage of the theorem we all learned in high school, which is that if you know the length of a baseline, if you can measure that, and you can measure the angles in an isosceles triangle that's using that baseline, you can determine the distance of the vertex. I don't know how many of you actually remember that theorem, but it's been used by scientists in all different disciplines. Base of the isosceles triangle. The angles at each end of that isosceles triangle gives you the distance to the vertex. And so traditionally, how astronomers use that to measure distances in our galaxy is they would look at different stars in the springtime and compare with the positions of those stars in the fall. And there you got the baseline of the diameter of Earth's orbit, 186 million miles. So you got that nice long baseline, and you measure the where that star is relative to very distant galaxies, for example, in the springtime, and you can see a change in the position in the fall, and that gives you the angles of both ends of the triangle, and you can determine the distance. However, given the resolution of optical telescopes, that gets you out to about 200 or 300 today, you can get out to about 400 light years. And what has happened recently to improve that is they've actually put telescopes on satellites. So there you actually don't have the problem of Earth's atmosphere lowering the resolution. And they take multiple measurements, literally hundreds, even thousands of measurements. And statistically, they're able to get you out to about 20,000 light years. But our galaxy is 120,000 light years across. So that technique gets you out to a significant portion of our galaxy, but not all of it. But recently, radio astronomers have been able to vastly improve this trigonometric distance measurement. And they use a different baseline, and they also use a system of telescopes to get much superior resolution. So what they actually do is they link radio telescopes together, literally around the world. And so they get a baseline. Basically, what they're doing is they're developing the resolution of a 5 or 6,000 mile diameter telescope. What happens at radio wavelengths is you not only get the amplitude of the wave, you get the phase of the wave. And that enables you, unlike what you can't do this in optical astronomy, but you can do it in radio astronomy because you've got both the phase information and the amplitude information, which allows you to build an interferometer where you take, say, a 10 telescopes literally around the world, and you can make the measurements. And then through a computer, you can link all the data together. And you're basically duplicating the resolving power of a 5 or 6,000 mile diameter telescope, as opposed to what you would get with a 400 inch optical telescope. And so, even though you're looking at a much longer wavelength, you get a far superior resolution. This very long baseline radio interferometry actually allows you to get a resolution of 1/10,000th of an arc second. About the best you can do with an optical telescope is about 1/10th of an arc second. The Hubble Space Telescope can get you down to about 1/100th of an arc second, but this radio technique gets you to 1/10,000th of an arc second. So you literally get 100 times plus improvement in resolution. And then they use a different baseline. What they actually look at are these radio maser sources. These are gas clouds that are orbiting above the centers of their galaxy. So instead of a 186 million mile baseline, they get a baseline of a few tens of thousands of light years. And so they get a much bigger baseline, much higher resolution. And by this means, they've been able to make trigonometric distance measurements out to 470 million light years. So we're actually getting out to a significant part of the observable universe. And they're able, with that distance improvement and the direct distance measurement, they can use that to calibrate what are called the distance ladder or standard candles. And so, for example, we know that Cepheid variable stars, their intrinsic brightness, the brightness at the source, is proportional to the period of the oscillation of the Cepheid variable star. So you measure the period accurately, that tells you how bright the star is. You look at the star through the telescope, and we know that the brightness of a light source decreases with the inverse square. So for example, if a star is twice as far away as a standard candle that's been calibrated by the direct distance measurement, we know it's four times fainter. And then we can do the same thing with what are called type 1A supernova eruptions. These are stars where we know the mass of the star when it goes supernova, so we know its intrinsic brightness. And again, you can, by the inverse square law, realizing if you double the distance, that means it makes it four times fainter. Triple the distance, it makes it nine times fainter. By that technique, you can go more than halfway out to the farthest observing point of the universe. That's because these type 1A supernova are very bright objects. So today we actually have really good tools for determining distances. Now, the closer the object is, the more accurate the distance. But thanks to this very long baseline interferometry and these type 1A supernova, we've got accurate distances out to about 10, 11 billion light years. And actually, I'm going to be talking about a technique. I'll probably mention it next week. There's a brand new technique for measuring distances that is assumption free. So I'm going to actually be able to complement this with the long baseline interferometry. And what's wonderful about this new technique, it's just been employed literally in the past year, is if you get two neutron stars that merge together, the gravitational waves can be analyzed to determine the distance of the object. And if it's a neutron star merging event, you're going to get electromagnetic radiation, which tells you how fast it's moving away from us. I'll talk about that either next week or 2 weeks from today. And I'm going to be writing an article on it. It'll be published probably mid-July on this new technique. But the wonderful thing is neutron stars emerge together to generate gravitational waves. We can see these at extreme distances. So good news on that front. And you actually get the age of the universe because when you look at the spectral lines, you can see the redshift that tells you how fast the object's moving away from us. And if you know the distance accurately, that determines the cosmic expansion rate, and the inverse of the cosmic expansion rate gives you the age of the universe. That's the most straightforward way to determine the age of the universe. And the answer you get is about 13.8 billion years back to the cosmic creation event. But actually the most accurate way to measure the cosmic creation date is by looking what are called maps of the cosmic microwave background radiation. These are maps of the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. And these maps basically show you the condition of the universe when it was 380,000 years old. This is when the universe goes from having nothing but ionized atoms, where you actually have nuclei with electrons orbiting it. So you actually have, for the first time, stable atoms where everything is not ionized. And when that happens, that's the first time you begin to see a distinction between darkness and light, hot spots and not so hot spots, cooler spots in the universe. And the sizes of those hot spots and cold spots at that time when atoms first form gives you an age for the universe. And if that gives you an age for the universe, it's accurate to about four places the decimal. The latest measurements of maps of the cosmic microwave background radiation establish that the universe is 13.79 billion years old, plus or minus 0.04. But as I'll be sharing in a couple of weeks, we have the potential within the next 2 years to actually significantly improve the measurement of the date for the creation of the universe and the cosmic expansion rate. And incidentally, establishing that date for cosmic creation and the cosmic creation rates, and incidentally, the cosmic expansion rate very slightly varies over the history of the universe, varies by about a half, maybe to 1%. And if we can measure with greater precision how that cosmic expansion rate changes over the history of the universe, it's going to give us even more compelling evidence that there must be a personal mind that was responsible for creating our universe of matter, energy, space, and time. It's also going to significantly generate more fine-tuned design evidence for this God creating the universe for the specific benefit of humanity. So thank you for asking those two questions. I'm actually writing an article on that right now, and I'll give a report on that in the Paradoxes class in the next week or two.
Great, Hugh. It's 10:46. Do you want to start?
Okay, I'll start. And we, for those of you who had additional questions, we are going to have a Q&A time after my teaching time. So let me begin by going to the share feature here. Okay, what's going on? Sorry. Okay, let me see if I can make this share work. Come on. Sorry, Jamie, it's not allowing me to share for some reason. Ah, here we go. Okay, now we're in the share mode. And before we get going on this, this is a special day for my wife and I and our sons, because my younger son today is going to be getting his doctoral degree in clinical neuropsychology. And so this is the Paradoxes class, but as far as our family is concerned, this is the day when our family becomes a pair of docs. Sorry for that not so good joke there. But yeah, we're gonna be celebrating that this afternoon. And those of you who have been surveying my Facebook page will realize a report came out yesterday. And this is a verified report of a man who was swallowed by a whale, was in the mouth of the whale for a few minutes, and then the whale spit him out. So I made a comment yesterday on my Facebook page. You know, this is actually gives us more confidence in the story we see of Jonah and the whale in the Old Testament, in the book of Jonah. This what happened was there was this scuba diver. So he had his scuba gear on. So, but he just felt this, sudden thing. And then he found himself in the mouth of this whale. And he was there for a few, so it was dark and he was wondering what was going to happen. He got bruised, but then the whale went up to the surface because he got picked up by the whale when he was underneath, I think a depth of 45 feet. So when he got swallowed by the whale, but the whale came to the surface and spit him out at the surface. And he had a few soft tissue bruises, but that was it from the experience. A lot of people have commented that this is interesting, how the whale went to the surface first before spitting him out. Normal response is just spit him out right away. And what's interesting is this is not the first time this has happened, by the way. There have been several individuals that have been swallowed by baleen whales and have survived. And when you look at a baleen whale is a whale that basically feeds by having a huge mouth that sucks in a huge, basically gulps a big volume of water, and then and its mouth basically has this filter where it blows out all the water, and then the plankton, the krill, small fish, whatever, remain behind, and that's what it eats. However, a whale is a mammal. It's air breathing. And I've written about this years ago. We actually did a television documentary on this, because there's lots of evidence about whales doing altruistic acts to save human beings. And therefore, it would not be out of character for God to command a whale in the same way he commanded the ravens to feed Elijah. I mean, if you read the story there, Elijah was isolated on this hilltop, but God sent ravens to give him bread and flesh every day. And, you know, ravens have a great affinity for humans. I know people, my own dad had a pet raven, and they can bond very strongly to a human being. But likewise, whales do. Whales have a strong affinity for humans. And incidentally, I think that's one reason why we came so close to wiping out the whales. Because what you see in the whaling literature a couple of hundred years ago is these ships would go out to hunt whales, but it wasn't hard for them to find them. Whales had such a strong affinity to be with humans. They would actually come towards the whaling boats rather than run away. And consequently, came close to wiping out the whales. In fact, the feeling was that we may have actually wiped out some whale species, but amazingly, a number of them have survived. But there are many instances of whales helping humans. And therefore, the story in Jonah, given that context, God could have sent this a big baleen whale. And keep in mind, with a baleen whale, a third of its body volume is its mouth. So there's lots of room in, quote, the belly of the whale. That's the phrase you see in the English translation, but that would include the mouth of the whale. And therefore, Jonah was sitting in the mouth of the whale, and the whale was on the surface. Jonah would have air to breathe, but it'd be like he was in this dark prison room, and the right time, the whale spit him out on the beach. That's what's interesting. The whale came all the way into shore and spit Jonah out right on the beach, where he could get up and walk towards Nineveh. And as far as this affinity with whales, one of my relatives, my cousin, had an experience. He was living on Vancouver Island, and he said he was out on a small one-man rowboat out in the Georgia Strait between Vancouver Island and the British Columbia mainland. And he said this 50-foot gray whale came right up beside him. A gray whale is a baleen whale. And this whale came right up beside his rowboat, and he was terrified. He thought his rowboat was going to capsize. He was going to be in the sea. The water was cold. He didn't know what was going to happen. But what happened is a gray whale very gently came up beside his rowboat and basically stayed beside the rowboat. And my cousin John basically began to touch the whale and realized the whale wanted to be stroked. So he just sat there stroking the whale while the whale calmly sat by his rowboat. So he kept that up for about 5 or 10 minutes, and then the whale disappeared. And he said, well, that was an interesting experience. But he says a few minutes later, that big whale came back with her calf and basically pushed the calf up by his rowboat so that the calf could experience being stroked by my cousin. That's just one example out of many that I could tell about how whales have this strong bond with humans. And therefore, the story we see in Jonah, I think, is consistent with how God created whales. And of course, this is a whale just like the raven, where God basically commanded the raven. He commanded and controlled the whale to swallow Jonah out there in the sea and protect and preserve Jonah's life for 3 days and three nights, then spit it out in the land. Mind you, as it says in the book of Jonah, Jonah went through some significant thinking while he was in the mouth of that whale. And he thought it was all over, and he began to consider his life and how he had disobeyed God. So he's going through a significant meditation while he was in there. And after 3 days and three nights, he resolved to change his mission. He was rebelling against the mission God gave him, but those 72 hours persuaded him, hey, this is God's doing. I wouldn't have survived this incident if God wasn't looking out for me. And therefore, he began to say, I will obey the Lord. And being 72 hours in the mouth of the whale, he would have been subjected to a lot of the chemicals and the saliva of the whale. And it's quite possible that after 72 hours, his skin might have been significantly discolored and he might have been bounced around inside the whale. He might have had a lot of bruises, but that probably was something God used to catch the attention of the citizens of Nineveh when he went there to preach. So that's some background. You can go to my Facebook page and you can actually get a link to the original article, and several articles have also been written about similar accounts of humans surviving being swallowed by a whale. And by the way, there's not a single story of a human being swallowed and digested by the whale. They've always been spit out by the whale. So with that, let me jump into the teaching. We're on this series on dual revelation, how God reveals himself through two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture. As I've been sharing this past few weeks, this is a doctrine that's not only being attacked by unbelievers, it's being attacked by believers within the church, including several very conservative doctoral level theologians. I'm personally involved in a battle. It's a friendly battle. It's not like the acrimonious attacks I get within the young earth community, but nevertheless, it's a spirited debate on whether or not the two books doctrine we see in the Belgic Confession actually is as it's described in the Belgic Confession and in the statements of the International Council of Biblical Inerrancy. So this is a current theological debate that's going on today. In my opinion, this is a debate that has great significance for the church and for the fulfillment of the Great Commission, which is why we're devoting some time to this. But I've actually got a scientific discovery that I want to share with you that ties into this teaching on the two books doctrine. And it's outside of my discipline. And I know there are PhD level biologists that are part of this class. So they want to jump in the Q&A time. I'm going to give them that right to be able to do that. And for those of you who know that I'm an astrophysicist, during my teenage years, I was actually enrolled in a science enrichment program in British Columbia. And they all asked us, I mean, basically they recruited the 25 top science students there in the southern part of British Columbia. And they had us take lectures every Thursday evening with science professors at the University of British Columbia. And then on weekends, we would do research projects with these professors. But it's interesting how they organize it. I don't think I've ever said this before publicly, but they would question us and they would find out what, you know, what were the students they selected were not only very gifted in their science, they also had established what they wanted to do once they got to the university. So all 25 of us had a clear idea of what kind of scientist we wanted to become. But in this science enrichment program I was exposed to as a high school student, they made it a point of having us get lectures and training from professors or outside our discipline. So when they found out it was astrophysics for me, I did indeed get to do some research projects with an astronomy professor at the university there. But most of my exposure was in disciplines that have nothing to do with physics and astronomy, because the goal was they knew we're all focused to a highly specialized science career, and they wanted to make sure we had a balance in the other sciences. So for that reason, I feel like I can dive in to science disciplines outside of astronomy and physics. And incidentally, when I did go to the university, I did take courses on geophysics as well as mathematics, astronomy, and physics. And I would sit in on lectures on biology. It's just some background, but hey, this page here just shows you that if you don't get to ask questions in the paradoxes class, I do take questions on Facebook and Twitter. And hey, if you're not already enrolled, I encourage you to enroll on the Reasons to Believe YouTube channel, and reasons.org is our website. The book that's most relevant to the two books doctrine is this one, More Than a Theory, and you can get a free chapter of this book and others of my books at reasons.org/Ross. And we also have this DVD documentary that we made years ago, Dual Revelation. And so you can get that at reasons.org at our store. And this is the address you're going to need the URL you're going to need to get into our Zoom meeting. And what we've been doing in our Zoom meetings, this is a meeting where we can all turn our cameras, we all can turn our microphones, we get to engage one another, get to know one another. But we also get to role play dealing with the kinds of questions that we get from skeptics, atheists, people who call themselves nuns or agnostics. And I got a little exercise for us prepared for today. And I think this also helps us to be better prepared when God does give us opportunities. But the opportunities I'm talking about is where you meet somebody, they bring up an issue, and you got maybe 1, 2, or 3 minutes to respond. So that's where we're going to be going with that. And so moving into the topic at hand, this is a discovery I'm going to be dealing with. And it's basically a paper that got published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And it's all about an attempt to explain the history of life on planet Earth from a strictly naturalistic perspective. But when I read the paper, the irony was it actually provided more evidence for a creation perspective of life history. So what I'm going to review for you are their attempts, what they discovered, their attempts to fit it into a strictly naturalistic model, and why this actually provides us with stronger evidence than we ever had before that we need the intervention of a supernatural, super intelligent God to explain the history of life here on the planet Earth. And hey, believe it or not, I've been to places where the fossils, this is actually a rock I picked up. It was about, maybe a foot in. It was about 10 inches across. So yeah, look at this as a rock that's 10 inches across. And these are all the fossils I found in the rock. This happened when my wife and I first visited the fossil beds of the Cambrian explosion on Mount Stephen in Yoho National Park in British Columbia. And that park was the site of the first discovery of the Cambrian explosion of fossils. And so this particular piece of rock I had, I counted 9 fossils in the rock, the most spectacular ones being these trilobites. But from a naturalistic perspective, the claim is that all life on Earth is descended by natural means from what they refer to as the last universal common ancestor, or what they call LUCA. And basically what you see in evolutionary biology, they just assume that somehow by natural means, chemicals organized in such a way that out popped a single bacterium. And from that single bacterium, all life evolved into human beings. All this happened without any divine intervention. And most evolutionary biologists really haven't studied the origin of life. This is something that Faisal Rana, our staff biochemist, and I have been very involved in for the past 25 years, going to Origin of Life research conferences and basically trying to communicate the point. The origin of life, we can easily demonstrate, must be a supernatural event. And what's happening is with every successive international conference on the origin of life, they're coming with more compelling evidence that naturalistic models can't even develop a scenario, let alone a hypothesis for the origin of life. But most evolutionary biologists just simply assume there is a naturalistic solution to the origin of life, even though they readily admit they don't know of one or can't even conceive of one. They say, well, let's just assume we've got this microbe. And then what they talk about is how through genetic mutations and or gene exchange, you get changes in the morphology of this bacteria. And this is a term that's used by evolutionary biologists. Morphology simply refers to the body structure, the exterior and the interior body structure, whether it be the skeleton or the circulatory system, just the way the cells are organized. That's all referred to as the morphology of the species, the structure, the size, the function of the physical features that make up the organism. And the assumption is this is all driven. The changes in the morphology of these creatures is all driven by changes in the genes. And so there's these mutations that happen in the genes. And at least at the microbial level, we do see the capacity for some microbes to actually exchange parts of their genome with other microbes. And whether that extends into higher forms of life is still debated to this day, but we do see it taking place at least at the microbial level. And they're saying through that combination, we can explain 100% of the morphological changes that have happened since the appearance of the first microbe and the display of 8.5 million different species of eukaryotic life forms today. So the claim is that therefore, if this indeed is the case, and this is a statement I've been making for the past 30 years, if the naturalistic model for the history of life indeed is a correct explanation for why life history has taken the form that it is, the genomic changes should always match the fossil record changes. The fossil record basically documents the changes in the morphology. You get the fossils and at least give you some indication of what's happening at the morphological level. But if this naturalistic model is correct, the genomic changes should always match the fossil record changes. Incidentally, that's also possible if you got God supernaturally intervening here. God could direct the history of life in such a way that genomic changes do match the fossil record changes. However, from a supernatural perspective, it doesn't always have to be the case. And this is something that the community of evolutionary biologists is beginning to acknowledge, is that there are places where the genomic changes do match the fossil record changes, but there's a whole lot of places where it does not. And where it does not, there's radical differences. And so this is recognized as a profound challenge to the naturalistic evolutionary paradigm. So moving on from there, the phylogenetic evolutionary trees should always match the paleontological evolutionary trees. This is a term that's used in the evolutionary biological literature. They talk about phylogenetic trees and they talk about paleontological trees. And then what they mean by a tree is you've got this LUCA, this last universal common ancestor. It experiences evolution. And so these genetic changes basically cause some variability or differentiation of the microbes. And eventually you see that the microbes split into two different species, where one microbial species will not engage the other one in any significant way. And they call that a speciation event. And so then they refer to these branching trees, where you start with one species that branches into two, then to four, then to eight, et cetera. So for example, this next slide shows you, this is what you would call a paleontological a tree, where it basically shows how you start with this microbial life form, and it begins to split in different species of microbes. The bacteria, the archaea, those are all microbes. And so they actually dominate the life we see here on planet Earth. But then you get this third branch, the eukaryotes, where now you can have multicellular life forms. Not all of them are multicellular, but many of them are, and actually spawns the whole diversity of life. Or another way to look at it is with this diagram, where you again see the single species and it begins to branch into different species and eventually get, but this particular diagram that's often shown in evolution biology textbooks actually is a little more accurate to what's happening in the fossil record, namely that you see species existing for a significant period of time without observed morphological changes. And then you get a sudden break where you see in a short period of time a dramatic morphological change, and it stabilizes and remains stable for a period of time. Then again, you see a sudden morphological change take place and then in the species. So it's basically characterized by long periods of stasis where nothing is really changing. And then you got these brief episodes where you get these dramatic changes taking place. However, what's been happening in the literature the last several years is the acknowledgement that there are significant mismatches that are taking place in these naturalistic models. That the fossil record dates, for example, for the morphological changes contradict the molecular clock dates. So you look at what's happening at the molecular level of the gene. You can use that to determine a date from when these morphological changes take place, but those dates don't match the fossil record. You say, how off can they be? Well, typically they're off by 10 or 20 or 30 million years, but there are examples where the molecular clock dates are disagreeing the fossil record dates by a quarter of a million years. So we see massive discord between the dates you get from the fossil record and the dates you get from the molecular clock. And it is recognized in the evolutionary and biological literature that the fossil record is the most reliable. You're getting the most reliable dates from the fossil record. You can actually see the morphological changes, and we've got good dating tools to determine when those happen. And so what is really being questioned is the molecular clocks. And then there's attempts within the evolutionary biological community to find some way to reconcile the dates we get from the molecular clocks and the morphological clocks. But you can get this article I wrote back in 2019, where I was commenting on papers in the peer-reviewed literature, where I described how they were attempting to reconcile this discordance and basically conceding that they could see no way to reconcile the discord. And they didn't mention this, no way to reconcile the discord from a naturalistic perspective. From a creation perspective, there are ways to reconcile them, but not from a naturalistic perspective. So you can read that article. It's titled New Speciation Model Challenges Evolution, Supports Creation. And it's in my Today's New Reason to Believe blog series that I post every Monday. And this was on August 19th, 2019. So yeah, if you go to the blog section of reasons.org, you'll be able to find that, or just put into the search engine, speciation model challenges or speciation model. That'll probably pop up the article for you. And then what I'm gonna be writing an article about, it won't be out until sometime. Well, it'll be out probably late. It might be out later this month. I don't know when it's scheduled, this is a quote from the article that was published on May 11th. And incidentally, because of the significance of the paper, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science actually gave an advance release. So it's not yet in the printed journal of PNAS, but they did release it ahead of publication. And you can read the whole article as it is. And they actually made it publicly available. So that's the information you're going to need to actually get to the paper. And of course, I'll give you a link to it directly when the article comes out later this month. But this is a quote from the paper where they're basically looking at what they call gene tree conflict. And gene tree conflict is basically looking at, pardon me, let me pull this back. Sorry. I'm running two computers here. Here we go. That gene tree conflict basically refers to simply the discord we're seeing between the paleontological trees and the phylogenetic trees. And they're basically, this is a quote from the paper, instances of high gene tree conflict in mammals, birds, and several major clades correspond to rate increases in morphological innovation. Basically making the point, we see the highest discord between the paleontological trees and the phylogenetic trees, where we have the greatest rate of change taking place in the morphological structure of the different species of life. And they make the point in the paper that this is unanticipated from a naturalistic perspective. It's not what you'd expect. You'd expect the opposite, but this is what we see. And then they go on to make the point that the greatest examples of gene tree conflict correspond with the highest rates of morphological innovation, and they occur episodically throughout Earth's life history. Again, this is unanticipated from a naturalistic perspective. It's not something that we see continuously. There's these brief episodes where we see this huge gene tree conflict. And it's also these brief episodes where we see extremely high rates of morphological change. But most of the paper is devoted to trying to explain both this episodes. And the episodes are long. It's about every 30, 35 million years, we see these episodes of huge gene tree conflict, and at the same time, these extreme rates of morphological change going on. And so they attempt in the paper to explain how this could happen from a naturalistic perspective, and basically make the point that complex population level processes are what's going to explain what we see there. And what they mean by complex population level processes is that we have these species of life either experiencing extremely rapid population growth or extremely rapid population collapse. So where they're going from, say, tens of millions of individuals in the species, where it drops down to a few hundred, or where it's at a few hundred and rapidly rises to many millions of different species. And they're saying it's this rapid change in the population levels of these different species that explains both the discord between the paleontological trees and the phylogenetic trees, and also the extremely high rates of innovation. But this is where I think their explanation fails. And incidentally, I've been waiting to see if there would be a critique of this in the peer-reviewed literature. However, given this is an advanced publication, I think it's going to be at least a few more months before we see these coming out. It'll be interesting to see what people from a non-Christian perspective say of this. But the problem is, and again, this is not commented on in the paper, they don't mention field observations, but field observations consistently show that extreme population growth or extreme population collapse does not produce morphological change, radical morphological change, the spawning of many new species of life. Rather, what it predicts is extinction. That if you get rapid population collapse, it reaches a point where the species simply isn't able to do with the environmental features that are driving the collapse. When you see a collapse from, say, 10 million species down to a few hundred, that's usually because environmental factors are wiping out the individuals in the species. And the smaller the population level, the less capacity of the species to recover from the environmental stress. And so they have more possibilities of surviving when they're at the millions of individuals than they do when that there are hundreds of thousands, or the hundreds of thousands, or in the tens of thousands. And when it drops below 1,000, extinction's guaranteed. Extinction is guaranteed unless you've got human beings coming in to rescue the species and basically come in and provide barriers, remove the environmental barriers that are driving the extinction. But it's kind of making the same point that if you've got a species rapidly declining under naturalistic conditions, it's going to take someone like a human or a superhuman or a god to intervene and prevent that species from going extinct. Incidentally, you got the same problem when a species rises at a rapid rate. where it goes from a few hundred very quickly up into the millions. When that happens, the species winds up consuming all the nutrients it needs or the food supply it needs, and basically winds up starving to death. And again, we see this in field observations. Wherever you've got extremely rapid population growth, it always leads to catastrophic population collapse and the extinction of the species. And so this right away is a fundamental problem with the suggestion, the hypothesis that's put in the paper to explain this great discord that's consistently seen and this high rates of a morphological change that's going on. And this was actually published back in 1987. And by the way, Irwin and Valentine have come up with an update. They've actually published a full-length book on this a couple of years ago that you can get. But way back in 1987, they made this comment based on their analysis of these events where we see a huge amount of morphological change going on. And they're mainly focused on things like the Avalon explosions and the Cambrian explosion and what happened after the mass extinction event of the Triassic era, what happened when the dinosaurs are wiped out. There are periods where we see species of life going extinct at a rate of above 50% of all the species of life on planet Earth being driven to extinction, typically by a giant asteroid collision that ignites volcanic eruptions around the world, changes the chemistry of the planet. But after each of those mass extinction events, we see mass speciation events. And Irwin and Valentin and Sikorsky, back in 1987, in their study of these mass speciation events, made this comment. There are no indications that the evolutionary activity at the family level was driving the origination of higher level taxa. And the point there is, that is a fundamental assumption that's behind every naturalistic model to explain the history of life on planet Earth. That it's changes that take place at the species level that generate the changes at the genus level, which generate changes at the order, and then the family, the class, all the way up to the phylum. But they made this comment way back in 1987. That's not the way it looks when we see these mass speciation events. And moreover, they note the following. That the diversification of phyla occurs before that of the classes, and the diversification of the classes occurs before that of the orders, and the orders before that of the families. And what they write in their recent book, Irwin and James Valentine's recent book on the Cambrian explosion, is that maybe naturalistic models might be able to explain the appearance of new species, maybe even new genera, but the problem is they can't explain the diversification that occurs at the higher levels. And they said, when you look at these mass speciation events, what we see is that new phyla appear more suddenly and earlier than the appearance of new classes. And the appearance of new classes appears suddenly and earlier than that of new orders. And likewise, the diversification of new orders appears suddenly and earlier than that of new families. And so he says it's the exact opposite of what you would see from a naturalistic perspective. The interesting thing here is both Irwin and James Valentine are committed naturalists. They're not theists, they're non-theists. Yet they claim in their book that we have to be true to what we see in the fossil record. And what the fossil record tells us is that the phyla show up first. New phyla show up before the new classes. They show up more quickly and more suddenly than the new classes. And we see that the new orders show up after the appearance of the new classes. And so it's the exact opposite of what we see from a naturalistic perspective. And I do appreciate Irwin and Valentin in their new book basically saying, naturalism is not capable of explaining the appearance of new animal phyla. And what we see, for example, in both the abalone explosions and the Cambrian explosions, we see this sudden appearance of many phyla all at once. And they recognize that this is a profound challenge to any naturalistic explanation for the origin or for the history of life on planet Earth. And what I would add is that these observations, on the other hand, perfectly match what we would expect of the actions of a supernatural mind that's intent on compensating for the sun's increasing brightness while ensuring life is as abundant, diverse, and enduring as the laws of physics permit. You know, Valentine and Irwin are basically making the point that what we see in the fossil record profoundly challenges naturalistic, strictly naturalistic explanations for the origin of life. Now, to be true to what they write in the book, they do think naturalistic evolutionary means might explain the morphological changes, or at least some of the morphological changes that are taking place at the species level and the genus level. Their point is, we see no way that it could explain it at the higher levels, especially at the level of a new phyla and a new classes. And that they don't comment what I'm saying here. This is not in their book. This is unique to us at Reasons to Believe. As far as I know, we're the only ones making this point. That we see in the fossil record, this discord between the phylogenetic trees and the paleontological trees, and these episodes of extreme morphological change would actually match exactly what you'd expect for the actions of a supernatural mind concerned to compensate for the sun's increasing brightness, and to do so by ensuring we got the right life on planet Earth at the right time in order to perfectly compensate for what's happening in the sun. And this is simply an example. In the 21st century, science has become so specialized that astrophysicists rarely talk to evolutionary biologists or to paleontologists. I know of very few, but I've yet to meet an evolutionary biologist who's taken any note of what's happening in the changing physics of the sun. But this particular slide here shows you, and this is something we astronomers can actually produce with great accuracy and confidence, that the sun, as it forms during its formation stage, very quickly and dramatically increases in brightness. With the sun, for example, we know that the sun, when it was going through its formative stages, became about twice as bright as it is today. Once it finished its formation, then it began to lose mass at a relatively slow rate, and that causes luminosity to decline. And then it reached a point where nuclear fusion kicked in, the fusion of hydrogen to helium in the core of our star, the sun, that stabilized the loss of mass, so mass loss became extremely tiny thereafter. And the ongoing fusion of hydrogen to helium actually increased the core density of our star, the sun, and an increase in core density caused our sun to become progressively and gradually more efficient in the operation of the fusion of hydrogen to helium, which explains this ongoing brightening of the sun. And over the history of life on planet Earth, the sun has become about 23% brighter than it was at the origin of life 3.8 billion years ago. And in order to keep life on planet Earth, it's necessary that you have just the right life forms on planet Earth at just the right time in order that those life forms may draw down greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere. And the principle here is we've got the sun getting brighter and brighter, but if we can reduce the greenhouse effect of Earth's atmosphere at the same rate that the sun is brightening, then you can sustain an optimal temperature on the surface of the Earth that enables a wide diversity and abundance of life to persist throughout those 3.8 billion years. And what I'm basically saying is the following, that it takes someone with a mind and with the power who knows the future physics of the sun, the Earth, and the moon to remove no longer compensating light and replace it with just right light forms at just right times, in just right amounts, and in just right locations on planet Earth. And so this actually explains both the mass extinction events and the mass speciation events. It explains the periodicity of these mass extinction and mass speciation events. Notice that the sun is brightening rather slowly. It took 3.8 billion years to brighten by 23%. And so in order to sustain the optimal temperature on the surface of the Earth, solar physicists have determined that you're going to want to have an overturn of life on planet Earth about once every 30 to 35 million years. And what's interesting is that the solar system orbits about the center of our galaxy. It goes up and down through the plane of our galaxy with a periodicity of about 33 million years. That's significant because when we go through the plane of our galaxy, what that does is destabilize to some degree our asteroid and comet belts and explains why periodically, once every 30 to 35 million years, we get hit by a big asteroid or a big comet or a couple of asteroids and comets, which brings about this mass extinction event that is followed by a mass speciation event. But it's the removal of life wholesale from planet Earth, where 50 to 80%, 90% of the species of life on planet Earth is removed at one time by a sudden catastrophic event. And then you replace that life with new life. And the new life is created in such a way that it's more efficient on drawing down greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. So it's this periodicity of removing life from planet Earth and immediately or very soon after replacing it with life that is more efficient at just the right rate of pulling out greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And therefore we can sustain an abundance and diversity of life. In fact, an increasing abundance and an increasing diversity of life throughout the entire 3.8 billion years. And this is exactly what you see in God reveals himself through the book of scripture. He also reveals himself through the book of nature. And there are multiple creation psalms, but the one that's the most extensive is Psalm 104. And if you read Psalm 104, it talks about how God constantly putting this is how Psalm 104 ends. It basically says, "I," referring to us, for you, the Psalm 104, 29, and 30. That off. Looks like we had an internet dropout here. I assume you're all with me again. Let me double check. Yes, I see you're all still there. So what I'm going to do is I'm almost done. I'm going to pick up where I left off and we'll take some time for questions. And I'm going to let the biologists that are here to also comment on what I've been talking about for the past 30 minutes. Let me go back to share screen. Get my microphone back on. I think this is happening on my end. My apologies. Looks like our internet service where I am here in Southern California is unstable. So that's only happened to me about, well, it happened once 2 years ago. Hopefully it won't happen again. I'm not going to go back to the share screen feature, but I will share with you two more Bible verses that are things. Creatures. And then what you see in Isaiah 45 verse 18, speaking about God, he did not create it, referring to the earth to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. And if you want to read more about this, basically making the point that it was God creates, his intent is to fill the earth with as much life as possible, as diverse as possible. And what I find interesting is research showing that at the beginning of humanity, the abundance and diversity of life reached a maximum here on planet Earth. The number of species on planet Earth has been increasing throughout the past 3.8 billion years, but it reached a maximum at the moment that God introduced human beings. And so God put us here, and we got the greatest diversity and abundance of life on planet Earth. If you want to read more about this, you can get my book, Improbable Planet. And again, you can get a free chapter at reasons.org/Ross. So, Jamie, why don't we go to the Q&A time? And I know we got you and Manati here in the participants, and I'm fine having him field some questions as well.
Right. He actually has a question too. Okay. He's down the line. Should I take his question first?
Yeah, take his question first. And, by the way, let him know he's definitely welcome to answer, because, I mean, I'm outside of my primary discipline, so I'm more than happy to help me field questions here.
Okay. So his question is, evolutionary scientists claim that mitochondrial Eve, sorry, microphone, where, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. Evolutionary scientists claim that mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam were never single individuals, but a population, and both would have lived in different time periods. How do we respond to such statements?
Great. Well, we've been engaging evolutionary creationists who hold that view that there was never a single couple. It was a population of females and males. They do concede, however, that when you look at the mitochondrial DNA evidence and to a less significant degree, the Y chromosomal DNA evidence, it indicates that the population was small. So they're not claiming that the ancestral population of humans was in the millions. They're basically arguing, well, what I've been hearing from the evolutionary biologists at the Biologos, for example, is they will take on a number that ranges from about 132 up to 10,000. So it's within that range. But when you actually look at the mitochondrial DNA evidence and the Y chromosome evidence, it is consistent with a small population. It's also consistent with all of us being descended from one man and one woman. So the one man, one woman thing is not ruled out. But it would be too strong for us at Reasons to Believe to say that the mitochondrial DNA evidence proves we all came from a single female. It's consistent with that, but it doesn't prove that. And our friends at Biologos do concede that point, that it's not enough to distinguish between the model we hold at Reasons to Believe and the model that's held at Biologos. And we cite papers at Reasons to Believe making the point that genetics really is not capable of giving you an accurate ancestral population. It gives you an idea, but it's just a rough idea. And incidentally, we do not know the diversity of the genetics in the eggs of Eve. You know, God created Eve from the dust of the earth and from what he took from Adam's side. And, you know, all females are born with all the reproductive eggs intact at that time. And, you know, it's quite possible that God gifted Eve with eggs that were much more genetically diverse than would be the case of a woman today. We don't know. And so if God indeed gave Eve genetic diversity, then we can explain all the genetic diversity. What's interesting too, is we do look at the mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosome evidence. It tells us that humans are relatively recent on the scene. And you know, again, you need to look at the data because the papers, the best papers I've seen in trying to establish a date based on mitochondrial DNA evidence, it's basically saying the first woman came upon the earth 150,000 years ago, plus or minus 150,000 years. Again, making the point that with genetics, you've got very large and often unknown systematic effects. So that explains why in the best papers, they actually show you the range of possible dates. And I've always made the comment, we actually get a more accurate date for when God created the first man and the first woman from the early chapters of Genesis than we do from our best scientific dating techniques. If people are interested, I've written an article in the past year on the dating, the scientific dating methods for determining the origin of humanity, and where I actually describe all the systematic effects and why it is that the dates we can establish through carbon-14 dating that humans have been here for at least the past 40,000 years. Some say 45,000 years. Earlier than that, carbon-14 ceases to be a reliable dating method. But it is reliable between about 1,000 years ago and about 40,000 years ago, or 1,000 years ago and 35,000 years ago. That's its range. But when you get earlier than that, we don't have any dating method that's free of very large systematic effects. Once you get earlier than 250,000 years ago, you now begin to pick up reliable methods. But between 250,000 years ago and 40,000 years ago, we do not have a scientific dating method that's free of huge unknown systematic effects. And so my advice is, whenever you see a published date on human origins within that date range, recognize that it could be off by many hundreds of a percent. In fact, I've seen cases where it was off by as much as 1,000%. So, but that article is posted on our website. You can check it out. But keep in mind, we do get reliable dates earlier than 250,000 years ago, and we do get reliable dates later than 40,000 years ago.
Okay, Stephen Posta from Spring, Texas, asks the following. The design of the eyes in our glorified bodies will need to be modified to be able to gaze upon the face of God in the New Jerusalem. Do you think that perhaps in addition to the sight we currently have, we might be able to see infrared or in ultraviolet as well? What about the eyes having the ability to magnify like a microscope or see great distance like telescopes?
An interesting comment. You know, as I interpret Revelation 21 and 22, it says it's a realm where there will be no decay, no death, which tells me there's no thermodynamics going on. It describes as New Jerusalem that comes and sits on the new earth. And it uses dimensions that we're familiar with, or measurements. And it comes out that this New Jerusalem is either some kind of pyramidal or cubical or some hyperdimensional shape, but it's got corners. And being 1,500 miles on each edge, that tells me there's no gravity in the new creation. Because with gravity, any object bigger than about 500 miles across will self-gravitate into a sphere. There's a reason why all big bodies in the universe are spherical in shape. It's because of the law of gravity. Also tells us there won't be a sun there, there won't be stars there, and that everything will glow with light. There'll be no shadows, no darkness, which tells me we're not dealing with electromagnetic radiation. And so what does it mean about the eyes that we're going to have in the new creation? And that also tells us a new creation is a place where we're not going to be married. We're not going to be in the kind of family structures we are here on Earth. And we'll be one, like the Father and Son are one, which tells me we're no longer going to be constrained to linear time. God's going to release us into geometric time. We're going to be able to spend continual fellowship with one another simultaneously with everybody else in the new creation. Something impossible in linear time, but could be done in two or more dimensions of time or their equivalent. Which tells me there's going to be physicality in the new creation. We'll be able to measure things with yardsticks, for example, but we could be in completely different dimensions. And it's going to be completely different laws of physics. And therefore, we shouldn't look at the eyes we have in the new creation from the context of the eyes that we have in this creation. I think we're going to be able to see a whole lot better than we see right now. Because we're going to be released into a different kind of light. So the physics of the eyes in new creation, that I think that's highly speculative, but I think we can count the fact that the new bodies we get in the new creation are going to be much more functional than the bodies we have now, and we got the guarantee they'll never decay, they'll never need repair, and likewise with our eyes. My eyes are not as good as they used to be. Notice I'm wearing glasses. I don't need glasses if I'm looking at something that's more than 30 inches away. But if I'm trying to read the print, if I'm trying to actually see, hey, I wonder who's actually participating in this webinar, I do have to put the glasses on. That was the case until 2 years ago. I've been told by my doctor that it's quite amazing to have that good eyesight up until your early 70s. But I tell people, hey, if you spend a lot of time in front of a computer and a lot of time looking through the telescope, that kind of keeps your eye muscles exercised, but there reaches a point where thermodynamics catches up with you. Thermodynamics is catching up with me. The eyes we have in the new creation, they're not going to decay. They're not going to run down. They're going to maintain fully functional in the new creation. But exactly the physics of the new eyes, I can't speculate.
Thanks, Hugh. Greg asks, can a person live secretly as a Christian to keep peace with their family or to avoid community persecution? He also has a follow-up question. He's curious if AJ Roberts will ever be returning to RTB.
Okay, with respect to that, AJ Roberts was with us, and Jeanette was with us for a couple of years at Reasons to Believe. What happened was that during the pandemic, she got an offer she is a virologist. And so she actually thinks she's going to have a bigger impact for the scientific community and for the gospel. And we said, hey, have our blessing. Because what she's now doing is basically participating in the peer review of patents and research papers that have to do with pathogenic viruses. And she's having opportunities to share her faith in that context. And so she's living quite close. She does most of her work virtually. So her employer is in Washington, D.C., but they're allowing her to work remotely from out here. That works for the kind of job she's doing. She's also helping people in the place where she's living. So she's still involved in ministry. And she's left open the door to come back and participate with us. But right now she's really focused on the responsibility she has in actually because her whole goal is for the world to be able to better respond to pathogenic viruses. We're kind of caught by surprise with this COVID-19, but there's, I mean, I agree with her. There is the potential to really take advantage of what we've been through this past year and a half and really be much better prepared for viral pathogens in the future and actually work towards eradicating them. I mean, I don't think we're going to eradicate COVID-19, but her whole point is we now have the technology to rapidly develop vaccines for these pathogenic viruses. And if we can find a way to globally and quickly bring these vaccines into the population, we can actually eradicate these viruses. That can even work on the flu. And there's even possibilities that that could happen with a common cold, which is also making a point. We need to be careful how we proceed with this, because it's possible that some viral exposure, some exposure by we humans to pathogenic viruses may actually confer a benefit upon us. And so that needs to be researched as well. And her whole point is viruses are a gift from God. And, you know, she and I have been involved in making the point that viruses serve multiple functions. If it wasn't for viruses, bacteria would have taken over the planet and there'd be no room for plants and animals. If it wasn't for viruses, we wouldn't have the rainfall and snowfall we need to maintain good conditions here. Viruses keep in check the bad bacterial pathogens that are out there. That's just a few of the purposes that viruses serve. But our whole point is God put us humans here on planet Earth to manage the planet, its resources, and its life for our benefit and the benefit of all their life. So I say God bless AJ. I think she's going to make a huge contribution to actually helping us better manage the viruses we have here on the planet to better serve all of humanity. And she is, Buzz is actually making a point, you know, this new technology actually has the potential of being able to use viruses, engineer them slightly in the lab, and use them to deliver the chemicals into the body to wipe out the tumors. So there's actually the possibility that viruses can play a major and very effective role in dealing with cancer. So a lot of excitement out there. She's right in the middle of it, and she's having opportunity to share her faith with her peers. What was the first question, Jamie?
He says, can a person live secretly as a Christian to keep peace with their family or to avoid community persecution?
Well, I've met many Christians. Matter of fact, when I was studying the Bible at age 17 for a couple of years, I kept that a secret from everybody. Nobody knew I was studying the Bible. I was concerned that if my family discovered what I was doing or my friends at the university discovered what I was doing, I was going to have to deal with a lot of persecution I wasn't sure I could handle. So I just kept it all secret. And I know, for example, in the Middle East and in countries where you can be killed for your Christian faith or killed for sharing your Christian faith, that people do keep it a secret. However, I think the New Testament is very clear. Being a follower of Jesus Christ means we're to be committed to be sharing our faith with people who are not yet followers. We're to be involved in the Great Commission. And I can see the value of keeping your Christian faith secret in one context in order to open up opportunities to share your faith in other contexts. I'd be concerned about someone who calls himself a Christian and keeps their Christian faith secret from every human being. I don't think that's the life that Christ wants us to lead. And, I've read many examples of Christians living in areas of extreme persecution who found very effective ways to share their faith and often brought their own persecutors to faith in Christ. You never know how God's Holy Spirit's going to work. And basically, I would leave it up to the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit gives you an opportunity to share your faith, take it. And the Holy Spirit says, not now. And it's important to listen to that as well, because there are times when sharing your Christian faith might actually drive someone farther away from Christianity rather than closer. So yeah, I think it depends on the context. I say you need to analyze each case. But if you see an individual that's terrified to make public their Christianity in all contexts, then I think you got reason to doubt. Have they really made Jesus Christ the most important person in their life? But I can see value in keeping it secret in some contexts.
Okay, we got less than 5 minutes.
Okay.
Doug McComb is asking from Monrovia, California, is asking, he's wondering, what are the supernatural powers of Satan and his demons? Can they read minds? If they cannot, how is it that Satan tempted Judas?
Sure, good question. And you know, Jesus himself said in the Gospel of Matthew that these demons do have miraculous powers. Now, they don't have the miraculous powers that God has, but they do have some. So Jesus basically said, don't presume that all miracles you see are from the hand of God. They may be from the hand of the evil one. And every miraculous act needs to be put to the test. And you see this in the first epistle of John. He makes a point too. When you see these miraculous events take place, test the spirits to see where they're coming from. But what you notice in the Gospel of John, you see Jesus performing miracles that only God can perform. Now, in terms of these miracles that the demons and Satan can perform, how they can actually do miracles through humans, basically they wind up taking control of the human, and through that human, they can perform miraculous acts or give forth knowledge that evidently that normally wouldn't be available to the human being. They can do that, but they need permission. In terms of whether or not the demons can read your mind, they can if you give them permission. They can even take control of your mind if you give them permission, but they need permission. And so this is why it tells us to be on our guard to ensure we're not giving permission. What do I mean by permission? If you're involved in the occult, that's basically giving permission for the demons to invade your life. As you see repeatedly in the New Testament, if you hold on to bitterness for a long period of time, Satan and the demons can take advantage of that bitterness to invade your life. This is why we're encouraged. Hey, if you've been wronged or slighted, you need to forgive. Don't go to bed with a significant bitterness upon your heart. And hey, if you need help to forgive someone, to release the bitterness, go to God. He will help you. I fully understand people saying, hey, I'm really struggling with this bitterness. I've been hurt. I've been hurt deeply, emotionally and spiritually. And I don't know how to get rid of this bitterness that I have on my heart. Well, if you go to God, he'll help you. And that to me is a key. If there's an individual that says, look, I don't want God's help with my bitterness. I've been wronged and I'm not going to forgive. They refuse to forgive. As it says in scripture, that gives Satan a foothold in your life. That gives the demons a foothold. And so go to the Holy Spirit to ask for help with that.
Great. It's 11:59 plus.
Okay. What I'm going to do, can you see, I was talking biology for 30 minutes, and Yuvan is a PhD level biologist. If he wants to make a comment based on what I said, I want to give him the opportunity to do that. But if he prefer not to, I'm going to go straight to the web meeting. But, find out if he'd like to make a comment. If he does, we'll make him a co-host. So Yuvan, if you want to put something in the chat feature to indicate your desires on this.
He does have a couple questions coming up. So
our questions? I just want to give him a chance to say something if he wants to say something to everybody, because this is his area of expertise as opposed to mine. Hey, do you see anything in the chat feature there, Jamie?
Oh, he says, oh, there it is. He says, oh, maybe next time, Dr. Ross, I'm not all that well prepared. So, yeah. Okay.
I'll give him a chance next week if he wants to say something.
Yeah, let him think about it.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. Give him time to think about it. But, Yuvan, I'm more than happy to give you a few minutes next week to make any comments what I said during that 30-minute time. So with that, what I'm going to do is go to the share feature again and show you that URL for those of you who want to participate in our web meeting where we can all turn on our microphones and cameras and communicate with one another. And yeah, I got a good role play exercise for you. So let me go there. Here we go.
I also shared it in the chat. So.
Oh, you did share in the chat. Thank you. Sure. Let me pull this up. Here we go. Okay, this is the URL you're going to need to get into the web meeting that we're going to be having. And I'm going to shut down the webinar, and those of you who can join us in the web meeting. And the exercise we're going to have here, let me pull this up. Here we go. Okay. What I want us to do in the web meeting after we introduce one another to ourselves is have a volunteer role play, someone who's going to try to attempt naturalistic models for the history of life. And then I'm going to have a couple of you role play given. And again, just think, I got 1, 2, or 3 minutes on how to respond to the challenge here and kind of think about what you heard today, what else you might know, and how you might get the conversation started. And I want us to think about that. Don't think about how you're gonna get the conversation completed, how you're actually gonna make your full point. When God gives you an opportunity with a stranger, where they're raising this issue of naturalistic evolution, explaining the entirety of life history, the goal is to get the conversation started and then maybe suggest a resource they can look at and an opportunity to meet again. I think often we Christians make the mistake of thinking, okay, I got 3 minutes. I got to close the deal in 3 minutes. Salespeople tell you that's not the way it works. You have to kind of plant a seed and begin to develop a relationship. So the goal here is to get the conversation started, get the person thinking, about things they may have not thought about before. So with that, what I'm going to do is actually stop the share feature here. And by the way, it's the same address we've been using for the past several months. So if you've been with us before, just come in the same way. And let me... Okay, here we are. I'm going to end the webinar now, and then I'll start up the web meeting. Again, those of you going to join us, I'll see you there at the web meeting. You will be put into a waiting room, so give me a few minutes to pull you out of the waiting room into the web meeting. And when you're in, please turn on your camera and your microphone. So I'll see